Yes, today's topic is about DNA, which stands for what? Deoxyribonucleic acid. Which, as the name sounds like, it is related to acids in that this is a polymer, a polyester of phosphoric acid. So we're going to see an essential structure of a DNA strand, which is repeating units of a phosphate group and a sugar, deoxyribose. Deoxy means lacking an oxygen. Ribose, one of our aldopentoses that we're familiar with from earlier in the quarter. So back and forth, sugar unit, phosphate unit, sugar unit, phosphate unit that have these various bases that are attached. From your old junior high or high school days, you might be able to regurgitate, like I was, the names of the bases without even having to look. So we have, what are the four bases that are in DNA? Really, you can't all, I thought you all took bio classes. Really, the four of them, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thyanine, right?
Yes.
And then there is which fifth one that we have in RNA? Uracil, which the book actually addresses the reason why there's the difference between the two groups. And there is also a difference between RNA, which has regular ribose, and then DNA, which has this deoxyribose. And the reason there is a reason there why there is the difference in the sugars that are used. So what I'm going to do today is do a quick overview of the structure. We're going to build up from those individual little bases. It is those bases, the sequence of bases that make up the genetic information that is encoded in both RNA and DNA. So we'll look at the bases. We'll look how those are attached to the sugar units, which make up these things called nucleosides, which then get attached to the phosphate units that make them nucleotides, which then get polymerized together to make DNA or RNA strands. And then we'll talk a little bit about the process of translation or transcription. Translation, turning the genetic information into amino acids to turn them into proteins. And transcription, which is the process of either replicating DNA or making RNA strands out of it, which then is used to make proteins. So let's start with the bases first. There are these five of them, and they're actually relatives of two simple heterocyclic compounds, which we hadn't studied before. There is a chapter on heterocycles, but I have never had the time to be able to teach the chapter. So the only thing that we're going to talk about in terms of heterocycles is that they're cyclic, and they have things other than carbon as part of the ring. That's what the term heterocycle means. So one of the two set of heterocycles is a bicyclic compound. Which I've already managed to get the structure wrong of. You know, somehow I damaged it, and I just keep forgetting to fix it before class. I know, I was heartbroken, because I was getting to be so fond of it. This is the molecule purine, and then a nitrogenous analog of pyridine. Do any of us remember what pyridine is? Do you remember that Chem 12B actually happened?
No.
So benzene, replace it with one nitrogen, that's pyridine. Replace it with a second nitrogen, and that's the compound pyrimidine. And, of course, there are nitrogens all over these compounds, which are why they act as bases. So now we do some simple substitutions of both of these compounds, and we're going to get the five bases that are in DNA. So adding just a methyl group to purine, and we get adenine. Add a ketone, or turn it into, well, not truly a ketone, more like an amide. And that'll give us guanine. Okay. Again, let me just point out that these are related structures. They'll come back in a moment when we talk about the double helix of DNA. Now, turning to pyrimidine, we do some substitution there. We get the two other bases that are found in DNA plus uracil, which is the one that's found in RNA. This is cytosine. Uracil is the same type of structure, except having another carbonyl instead of the amino group. And then add a methyl group to that, we get thymine. So these bases, as I mentioned beginning a lecture, get attached to sugars. So let's just remind ourselves, in linear form, what is the configuration of OH groups in D ribose? Because remember, it is D ribose that is biologically active. So what do I do? From top to bottom, left or right? Right, right, right. My goodness, you've already forgotten your sugars?
I think they're all in one side.
Are you going to be reliving your allose, altose, glucose, mannose, glucose, allose, galactose, talose over the weekend to get ready for the final? I hope so, because you will still have sugars on the final. It's the song that's in your heart. It's the song of chemistry. What other song can there be? Now let's cyclize this. This is going to make the furanose five-membered ring. Turns out that in DNA it is the beta form that we end up with. So this is regular old ribose in its cyclic form. The 2' deoxyribose. So what does 2' mean? The fact that we're not changing the carbon at the 2 position, because technically we would be talking about substitution at carbon. But if we talk about the things attached to carbon, we can use this prime notation to designate that we're talking about something besides the carbon itself. So 2' deoxy means leave the oxygen out at the 2 position. Everything else, however, is still the same. So it's technically not a carbohydrate in the rigorous sense because it no longer has the formula CH2O. But it is a carbohydrate derivative. What is the difference between the two sugars? Oh, I'm sorry, question. Oh, I never did put it in. Wow. You knew that, or you just were looking along in the notes?
No, you said for the thymine distinction, you just add CH3 and then you wrote
it. It's just nice that people are awake, that's all. So why ribose versus deoxyribose? It turns out having that adjoining hydroxy group makes this compound more susceptible to hydrolysis when it's part of its, in this case, RNA strain. RNA is something that is replicated on a temporary basis. So, okay, let me back up because I'm presuming everybody's still got the high school biochem knowledge, but let's just double check. The human genome is comprised of 23 different chromosomes, each of which has two pairs of DNA that form a helix, the famous double helix pattern that you've undoubtedly heard about before. What we're going to see is these different bases end up making hydrogen bonding pairs. So we normally in DNA talk about base pairs because if, for example, you have guanine, automatically on the other pair, its other side, you're going to have cytosine. In DNA, if you have adenine, that means automatically thymine is on the opposite side. Just from the structures of the molecules in themselves, they have exactly the right shape, along with those different phosphate and sugar groups, that they slowly make that helix as you go from one pair to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. That DNA information is in the core of each cell, and it's that information that has to survive in order for us to survive. Now, occasionally, though, that DNA is split apart, and then you make RNA out of it, which is used to then translate into proteins. The DNA itself is not used for that purpose. It stays together. But the RNA, in fact, in that process of going from DNA to RNA, sometimes there's a chemical reaction that shortens the RNA. There is, in fact, an awful lot of genetic information in DNA that's just garbage, or at least from what we can tell, is just extra information. In fact, isn't it something like just 2% of the information in DNA actually codes into something active? And the rest is vestigial, which, not being an expert, my recollection is that that may be so that there could be some self-repair. Because, you know, out of the thousands and millions and billions of different sequences that make up these DNA molecules, if something goes wrong, well, that means that something's going to be wrong with us. And, of course, you know there's all kinds of genetic-based disorders. So you want DNA to be less hydrolyzable, and it turns out getting rid of that group at the 2 position makes it much more of a robust, much less susceptible to reaction. RNA, since it's replicated and then can get destroyed, it doesn't need to stay around for as long. So the in terms of energy, it's just not invested to first create a structure that's more resistant, nor do you then need reagents that can power through breaking this apart if and when it's needed. So that's the difference between the ribose and deoxyribose. The deoxyribose is less chemically reactive, which makes for more permanent structure. Now, whenever you take one of these two sugars, combine it with one of the 5 bases, you get a nucleoside. You remember the term glycoside? What does that refer to? Yes. So you attach something to the anomeric position of the carbon. So in other words, these bases are going to attach at the 1 position of ribose or deoxyribose. So you make a glycoside out of a nuclear acid, so you get a nucleoside. And so we took adenine, for example, and we were to put it on ribose. We get what is called adenosine. So it would have this structure. Turns out for the purine-based compounds, I don't remember the nomenclature number, but it's the nitrogen on the bottom right-hand side, because it's the way that I'm going to be drawing it, that it gets attached to the sugar. Let me look, in fact, real quick. That would be the... let's see, purines at 9, pyrimidines at 1. So nomenclature, that's position 9. Pyrimidines, that would be position 1. So attaches to the sugar in the beta position. If I'm talking about regular old ribose, it still has that OH group at the 2 position. So this is adenosine. If we made it out of deoxyribose instead, the way that it could be notated is just to call it deoxyadenosine. Now, if we then take phosphate groups and attach, then we get nucleotides. So it's phosphate plus a sugar plus a base. It is one unit, you could say, that ends up making the DNA or RNA strand. Now, phosphate, as some of you might be more familiar with than I, is involved in redox reactions biologically. So you can have phosphate, diphosphate, which is called pyrophosphate, or triphosphate. And all three of these combinations can end up in nucleotides. It turns out to be just the monophosphate version that ends up in the polymer chain of DNA itself, but there are other places besides DNA that some of these compounds show up, which as soon as I draw an example compound, you might recognize the name of it. So if we take adenosine and add a triphosphate group to it. Allow you to write the structure out. Part of the reason I keep writing these things over and over again is so that I hopefully will start to memorize these. So there's our adenine base. We have ribose sugar. And it turns out it's at the 5 position, or technically, because it's on the oxygen, not the carbon itself, it is the 5 prime position, that the phosphate or pyrophosphate, or in this case, the triphosphate group, is attached. Triphosphate is an anhydride of phosphoric acid. So notice we link one phosphate through a common oxygen to the next phosphorus, which links to the next one. And negative charge. So this is a nucleotide. Because it is adenine that we used, then we'll abbreviate it with A. We do not put a little D in front of it. If you put a little D in front of it, that's the abbreviation for if we had used deoxyribose instead. We have a triphosphate instead of a mono or diphosphate. So adenine, which since it's part of the sugar now, adenosine triphosphate or ATP. Right, and some of you recognize the molecule ATP, and if you're interested in the molecule ATP, I refer you to chapter 26 that does give an introduction to biological pathways. So it talks a little bit about catabolism and the ATP cycle and NADH and other common oxidizing reducing agents in biochemistry. So what have we done so far? Seen that there are these 5 bases. We took one of the bases, stuck it on a sugar, that gives us a nucleoside. We then stuck a phosphate or di or triphosphate on there, that gives us a nucleotide. And now we put it all together, and that's going to give us our DNA strand. So let me draw that up, and please give me a few moments because this is going to take a little while. I'm going to show you the example of 2 of the base pairs. So as I said a moment ago, these bases end up hydrogen bonding with each other. In fact, some of you might have seen the cute little dolls that one of our instructors here has. Have you not seen? I'll ask to bring them to class. It's the DNA dolls. Yes, the amino acid dolls. I know. It's the perfect thing to give your little 1 or 2 year old to learn the amino acid, nuclear acids at an early age. You can come see them if you want to, or I will ask to borrow them. I don't know, but I think Alice actually put a link on the class webpage about them. It's there, right? Either I or she or both of us did. She might have put the necklace, which if you hadn't seen it, if you want to get some of your chemical bling on, you know, there's a website that sells various molecules made out of silver. So one of your classmates actually has been wearing, I forget which one it is. It's not caffeine. It's one of the amino acids.
I would have bought it.
Oh, they must have caffeine. They gotta have caffeine. I mean, okay. So, anyways, there's that link if you're interested. And then if you go back to the Facebook page, there's also a link to these cute little stuffed animals that I'm now going to show what they represent. So, oh boy, here we go. So this is thymine, which pairs up with adenine. Gesundheit. You're excused. This is not a complete structure on drawing yet, because I haven't shown the sugar or phosphate groups. I'm just making sure that I get the core structure correct. Here is that hydrogen bonding. And again, they're just the right shape to have a really good interaction with each other. I mean, this is what holds the two DNA strands together, not necessarily covalent bonds. It's just the fact you have millions of these pairs of bases that all perfectly line up with each other in terms of hydrogen bonding. Now I'll show you cytosine and guanine. So cytosine, remember, is similar to thymine because it's also a pyrimidine. Again, incomplete, so I haven't added the sugars. Okay, so left, cytosine. Right, guanine. Three hydrogen bonding interactions there. Oops, and I'm missing hydrogen. Okay, so it is the one position of the pyrimidine derivatives and the nine position of the purine derivatives that end up attached to sugars. If I'm showing DNA, then I want to show deoxyribose. So here we go. A couple of deoxyriboses coming up. I'm not going to complete their structures quite yet. Then we have the phosphate groups, which allow me a little liberty here because we're going to have to curve these bonds a bit. And I'm just putting one connection on it at the moment. We link the phosphate groups together, which it turns out that the phosphate connects to the other end at the 3' position. Which means this sugar connects to another phosphate. It connects to the rest of the chain. Down here we have the rest of the chain. Up here, rest of the chain. And then connecting to the 3' position. We have the rest of the chain. Huh? Actually, I don't know. I know this seems like kind of a random mess, but it is kind of cool to be able to just write out what DNA looks like. So, I don't know. I find this kind of interesting, even if I don't have it all memorized yet. To simplify what I was saying earlier, we have sugar, phosphate, connecting to another sugar, connecting to a phosphate. This is the same thing I just drew up above, just hyper-simplified. So there's the same representation. Two bases, hydrogen bonded, and then a polymer chain of DNA. How is this different from RNA? RNA single-stranded. Doesn't have the double helix. During transcription, which is where you copy, we'll get into that in just a minute. I want to talk about translation first. So, let's move on to translation, which at this point, let me switch over to some of the pictures that are in the text, because this is going to get impossible to follow without some better diagrams. So let me... What's that? Which, actually, the next time I teach this course, not maybe the summer, but the next time once I come back from sabbatical, part of... I don't know if I've described what I'm doing on my sabbatical project or not. I'm taking all the lectures from this past year. So all the written notes turning into typed text and proper computerized structures. All the audio notes I'm going to be dictating, whether I do it my own self or it's rather convenient that a bunch of different operating systems are suddenly getting dictation systems at the same time. But one way or another, I'm going to have all this material from your class that will eventually get turned into a textbook at some point. That's further down the road. But all these examples that I now know at the end would be cool if I were to introduce the beginning. Well, that's partly why I'm taking all this material, so I can make a more interesting class the next time around. That's my sabbatical project. Can I make it what?
Can you make an app out of it?
An app? There's an app for that? Well... I have an idea for how to arrange the content material that no one's done before, and everybody, like all these iPads and things, they have the perfect software platform for me to attempt it, but it doesn't do very good to talk about it if you don't want someone to take your ideas. But that actually I figured out 10 years ago and just haven't gotten myself disciplined enough to do it. But that's another story. Here is the pretty picture I want to show you. Yeah, pretty, isn't it? So, DNA strand that gets split apart and then replicated to make the initial RNA. As I've mentioned out loud a moment ago, sometimes this RNA strand is chemically modified from just the simple bases that are there, and they actually get split off into different kinds of RNA. Is this something that you all cover in any of the classes here?
Yes.
Okay, so there's... which is transfer, isn't it not? Transfer RNA, which if you look at the little shape of that, what that is there's three of the bases that are at the bottom of this that form Well, no. Okay, so I'm doing this backwards. This forms what's called an anticodon, C-O-D-O-N. A codon is a sequence of three of these bases that they get interpreted to be the different amino acids. So this 5' and 3' have to do with which direction along the DNA chain that you're reading, kind of like going from the amino end to the acid end of a polypeptide. So when following the chain, if you have the first of these bases, the second, and then the third, the combination of those, there's 64 combinations, four bases times four bases times four, and this is the matrix that shows which amino acid that gets generated. Or there are three combinations that say stop the process. What goes on here is you start from one end of the DNA and go to the other. Each pair, each group of three of these bases, each one of these codons, corresponds to an amino acid. So you have these transfer DNA or RNAs that carry the amino acid on the top of them. You can see the picture for them here that it stuck that amino acid on top. You then have the complementary set of these bases that would be at the bottom of the tRNA. So that once you get the RNA, these line up with the RNA, and then you have the amino acids, therefore, that are lined up with each other. There are enzymes that come along and zip each one of these amino acids to each other, and that's how you grow a chain of amino acids, in other words, how you make a protein. And of course, it's proteins, in other words, enzymes, that perform lots of functions within the body. So this is how we exist. So again, starting with DNA that gets split up into multiple forms, there's rRNA, which is ribosomal, and then M, messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is actually the subset of RNA that carries the codons that get turned into amino acid polymers. In other words, get turned into the polypeptides. I don't know enough to tell you how ribosomal RNA figures into this sequence. I guess the ribosome is just where the action of transcription occurs. The messenger carries the codon information, the ribosome performs it, and then it's the transfer RNA that carries the amino acids to the reactive sites. Yes?
They taught me, I used to say, they think now that the rRNA acts like a ribozyme, so the RNA will catalyze
everything going on.
Yeah, not all of them, but almost all of it now.
Gotcha. So it's like the factory, messenger RNA is the plan, and the tRNA is the individual parts. Now that's translation, which the text does show you the OCHEM version of it, which again I'm not going to attempt to write down, but this is essentially the same thing, that you can see where these groups of three letters line up with each other, and since this is now RNA, and I never told the story of uracil versus thymine. So it's a similar type of a thing where there's a tautomerization.
Oh,
yes.
I love that word.
There's a tautomerization that can happen with cytosine that eventually through chemical reaction can get us to uracil. Apparently in the process of transcribing DNA, one of these cytosines can be turned into uracil. Now, I'm trying to remember now what happens. Just forgotten it. Somewhere in this process, if there wasn't a correction factor, you could end up in a situation where when DNA replicates, it doesn't know which base to pair up with. But there are also self-correcting mechanisms that will convert uracil back into cytosine to keep the same four bases just within DNA itself. Now again, part of what's going on here, I think, is an energy situation, where just to have the structures with cytosine instead of uracil requires more energy, but again, since RNA gets destroyed afterwards, doesn't require that you take as much prevention. So same story as deoxyribose versus ribose. One's more reactive than the other. Same situation with uracil and cytosine. So having said that, let me come back to this other page. So you can see the sets of three bases that line up with each other. This shape here, that is the cartoon representation of the tRNA. This bottom part here is the thing called the anticodon, which lines up with the codon, the actual genetic information. And you can see up here where there's an amino acid that's been attached. This is showing two groups next to each other, one where you have the growing polypeptide that's about to get linked together by an enzyme. So to give the real short encapsulation of everything we've done today, we started out with the bases, talked about how those get attached to different types of sugars. Those sugars get attached to phosphates, which then make a polymer chain. That polymer chain has sets of bases, which are interpreted in groups of three once they make it to RNA. From DNA to RNA, some of that genetic information is thrown away. And once you get to the messenger RNA that actually contains the real coded information, again, in groups of threes, those are translated into amino acids, which get linked together to make proteins. And that's our brief introduction to DNA. Now, we have... That was not... No, you have to keep going. Come on, one more clap. So, we have a few minutes left. Did any of you have questions that you've come across in your studying for the final? Yeah, there's a final next week.
What?
Yeah, I know.
We have a lab quiz.
Oh, yes, which the lab quiz, you already know the topics for it. It's the Merrifield resin synthesis, the thalamidyl malonic ester synthesis, and the Strecker synthesis. It will take you comfortably under an hour to complete. So the final is going to have probably a little more of the carboxylic acid than the individual topics of carbohydrates or amino acids. Part of the reason why, one question of your sugar, of course, the sugar portion is going to be the Fischer stereochemistry proof. How many questions like that do you want on your final?
One.
Yeah, right, exactly, because you want to be able to finish your final. So same thing for amino acids. There's a lot of simple questions I can ask, like what's the structure of this aldetol or aldonic acid, aldaric acid. Some of the same simplistic things, because it is a final, so it's cumulative, so I am going to re-ask some of the same questions. But as far as number of topics and things we discussed, there's actually more of it in the carbohydrate section, or the carboxylic acid section. It's just that we went through it awfully quickly, because we had two quarters of OChem that were all related. This was all new stuff, so I had to explain it from scratch. About what? Well, the only thing on exam two I asked about was what was the Kiliani-Fisher synthesis and how was that piece of evidence that related the structures of rabinose, glucose, and mannose, which is actually step zero of the proof, or one, to know that there's a stereochemical relationship. There's still the fact that mannaric acid being optically active tells you something about the configurations of glucose and mannose, that arabinaric acid tells you something about arabinose's structure. Yes, I'm going to ask another question about the Fischer stereochemistry proof, but I'm probably unlikely to ask the same one. I'm anticipating here, because you are asking the same questions that students across the centuries have asked. Yes.
And you said something about Curtius and Hoffman.
Oh, yeah, that thing. The Curtius and Hoffman mechanisms, the rearrangements, you mean the... Practically the only things in terms of mechanism from the amine section that we covered that I haven't tested you on yet?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been saying all along that word yet anytime I've talked about those. Any other questions? We will have lecture on Monday, and it's going to be a review, but also I had section three ask again. Wait, you mentioned about doing a neurotransmitter lecture. What about that? So we'll have that Monday.
Review.
Well, we could do some review as well. Maybe it won't take the whole 50 minutes, but.
You don't need to do review.
But one way or another, there will be class Monday.